Anne Barrès, the author of one of the most acclaimed and beloved French novels of recent years, The Postcard, came to Books and Books and dazzled a room full of readers. Let's join those readers on this edition of The Literary Life.
I'm Christina Nosti, the Events and Marketing Director at Miami's independently owned bookstore, Books and Books. And tonight, it's my immense pleasure to welcome you to a very special evening with Anne Barrès to celebrate the publication of her amazing novel, The Postcard, translated by Tina Cover and published by our friends at Europa Editions. This book is the recipient of numerous literary awards, was a finalist for the Goncourt Prize, and has been a long-selling bestseller in France. I'd like to give special thanks to the Consulate General of France in Miami and to Villa Albertine for partnering with us to bring Anne to Miami. The Postcard is part family history, part detective story. It offers us a vivid portrait of 20th century Parisian intellectual and artistic life, an enthralling investigation into family secrets, and a poignant tale of a Jewish family devastated by the Holocaust and partly restored through the power of storytelling. It's receiving major national media coverage, including Anne's interview with Scott Simon on NPR's Weekend Edition, profiles in The New Yorker and The New York Times, and major reviews in The Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post, and The New York Times Book Review. Anne Barrès is the best-selling co-author of How to Be Parisian Wherever You Are, and the author of a novel based on the life of French writer Françoise Sagan. With her sister Claire, she is also the author of Gabrielle, a critically acclaimed biography of her great-grandmother Gabrielle Bouffet-Picabia, Marcel Duchamp's lover and muse. She's the great-granddaughter of the painter Francis Picabia. For her work as a writer and prize-winning showrunner, she has been profiled in many publications. To moderate tonight's conversation, we're joined by Brenda Diaz de la Vega, the Senior Director of Communications and Brand Development of the Instituto Marangoni, Miami. She has a 20-year track record of leading communication strategies in Latin America for some of the world's top luxury brands, such as Chanel and Prada, in addition to her role as editor-in-chief of Harper's Bazaar Mexico and Latin America, as well as L'Officiel Mexico. And now, without further ado, let's give a warm Miami welcome to our guests. Thank you.
Thank you, Christina. Good evening, everyone. Thank you for joining us. Welcome, Anne. Welcome to Miami. It's such a pleasure to have you with us. I wanted to begin with where it all started. So the first time that you saw the postcard, you were 24 years old. You were sitting at the table with your parents and your sister, and you read the four names. What crossed through your mind at that point, and how is your personal journey from that point until almost 14, 15 years later when you decided to write the book?
I'm so moved because the room is plenty full. As you will hear, my English is not so fluent. I will do my best, but Brenda will help me and her aunt. And also, it's a family business, if I need. First of all, I want to explain that it's a true story. This postcard exists. My mother received it in 2003. She received it in her letterbox. It was in January, so the postcard was hidden in the middle of the greeting cards. And when she saw the postcard, she recognize it immediately, the four first names which were written on it. Because these four first names were the first names of her grandparent and of her uncle and aunt. And you can see her aunt on the cover of the book. She's Noemi. She was 19 on this picture. And the photo was taken a couple of weeks before she was deported and murdered. So on this postcard, only four first names, nothing else, no signature, no message. And it was really frightening for us, because we didn't know who sent the postcard and why. So all the family were killed during the Holocaust in 1942, and someone sent us the postcard 60 years later. Someone who wanted to remain anonymous. So that day I was with my family. My mother showed us the postcard, and it was frightening because a lot of details were so weird on the postcard. For example, the stamp, which is here, was upside down. And I will learn during my investigation that an upside down stamp was, during the war, a coded language during the resistance fighters. For example, if they wrote a letter with "everything is okay, dad is great," with an upside down stamp, it meant "don't believe me." But the most weird thing was the picture on the other side of the postcard. It was a photography of the Opéra Garnier house in Paris. And for us French people, the Opéra Garnier house, house is a very known symbol of the occupation of Paris. Why? Because during the occupation, Nazis couldn't go to theater or watch movies because of the language. So they went every evening to the Opéra Garnier house to listen to music. That's why it's a symbol of occupation and of Nazis in Paris. So we were very frightened, and we had no idea of who could have sent the postcard. We had not the slightest clue, and that's why we decided to put the postcard in a drawer and to forget it.
And all those years that went by from that moment when you saw the postcard and you decided to write the novel, what happened? What was your personal journey like that led you to that decision to write the book?
Yes, it's 15 years later. And during 15 years, I never think at the postcard. And one day, it was a Wednesday, and every Wednesday, my mother has lunch with my daughter. She was 66 years old. And that day, she asked my mother, "Grandma, are you Jewish?" And my mother said, "Yes." "So, is Mom Jewish?" Yes, because it's things with the mother and you are Jewish if your mother is Jewish. So it means that I am Jewish? My mother said, yes, but why you have my daughter had a strange face. What? And my daughter answered, people don't like Jews at school. So in the evening, my mother called me and she explained the discussion she had had with my daughter. And she said to me, you have to go to the school. You have to ask the headmaster, the teacher, what happened. It's very important. You have to do that. But I was so shocked. I couldn't even ask to my daughter what happened. And psychoanalysts call that an obstacle avoidance. When you don't want to solve a problem, so you create yourself another problem. So during the evening, suddenly, I had like a flash. And I remembered the postcard. So the morning after, I called my mother and I said to her, Mom, do you have the postcard? Do you remember? She said to me, yes, but why? I want to know who sent it to us. And my mother answered, okay, that's not the problem now. And I asked her to help me to make the investigation. And she said, okay, if you go to school to meet the headmaster and the teacher, I will do the investigation with you. That's how it happened.
Mothers know best. The research process must have been so arduous and so overwhelming on so many different levels. On one hand, you were discovering very hard, sad truths about your past, about your family, your ancestors. And on the other side, there was just a lack of information, the reluctancy of people to speak out, to find, you know, the dates had been changed, names had been changed throughout everything. What kept you going?
During this investigation, something very strange happened to me. I had the feeling that my ghosts were around me.
Throughout the book, you guide us, the readers, along the path to revelations that it seems that we live simultaneously with you. How much of your past did you know beforehand, and how much of it was really truly discovered through the process of writing the novel?
I didn't know anything about my ancestors before writing the book. Why? At first, my grandmother didn't say anything about them, but I have to explain something about the silence of the Jews in France after the war. Because after the war, Jews were still afraid. You have to imagine that the neighbor who denounced you and your family was still your neighbor after the war. The policeman who arrested all the Jews in the building was still the policeman of the neighborhood. So after the war in France, Jews didn't want to speak. They didn't want to say that they were Jewish. For example, after the war, my grandmother decided to baptize in a church my mother, to have the paper and to be able to say, my daughter is Catholic, in case. And the priest of this church was good enough to say, okay, I will do that. Even he knew that they were Jewish. And I give another example in the book that one of my friend, he's older than me, his family changed the name of the family into a French name in the middle of the 60s in France because of anti-Semitism. So that's why one of the reasons why Jews didn't tell anything about what happened and who they were before the war. Other reasons, it was too painful. All her family was killed. She was the sole survivor. And she couldn't speak. She couldn't even pronounce the first names. It was so hard. And when I discovered the photographies of my family during my investigation, I thought something. Because, for example, Noemi, she looks my sister alike. They are the same. That's amazing. The same faces. And I thought it was hard, I think, for my grandmother to see the faces of her family in her children and grandchildren. I was so moved when I discovered it. Another reason of the silence of the Jews in France is that they were afraid to be not listened to. Because after the war, nobody wanted to hear about this story. Country had to think about future, not about war anymore. And so Simone Weil said something very important. And she said also, we didn't want to talk because we were afraid not being listened to, but worst, we were afraid to be not believed. And so that's why they preferred to stay silent.
Wow. There's a precise date in the book on October 8th, 1942, at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Two French police officers knock loudly on Emma and Ephraim's door. When Leila tells you that she has the name of the two policemen, you tell her that you prefer not to know. But throughout the book, what you're looking for are names, precisely. What you're looking for are pieced, you know, to clues to get more information. So I was curious to know, why did you choose to not hear those two particular names?
I regret, and I will explain why. But why I didn't want to write the names on the book. I am not an historian. I am a writer, a novelist. So I had the right to change some things. And I decided to change the names of people who behaved badly during the war. Okay, for example, in the book, you will read the letter that the mayor of the town wrote to denounce my family. All the words, all the sentences of this letter are true. I changed nothing, but I changed the name of the mayor because I didn't want the great grandchildren of this man could have trouble now because they are not responsible of what happened during the war. Of course, I gave the name of people who were heroics. We call them justes, les justes in France. All the people who gave their lives to help people. But collaborator, I changed. Why I regret to have done this for the two policemen? Why? Because when my book came out in France, we were in a moment of le moment des élections présidentielles.
During
the elections. And one guy who became very famous in France went to the media to say historians are totally wrong. The French government didn't collaborate with the Nazis, and it's wrong. French policemen never arrested Jews. And so that's why I regret, because I'm not an historian, but I think that literature is a gateway to history. And I think that if a teenager loves a book with an historical background, this teenager will one day open an historical book.
There was a very poignant paragraph in the book that I underlined when you tell your mother, "Maman, there comes a point when you can't just keep saying, 'But people didn't know.'" And she replies, "Indifference is universal. Who are you indifferent towards today, right now? Ask yourself that. Which victims living in tents or under overpasses or in camps way outside the cities are your invisible ones?" I thought that was very powerful. And I wanted to ask if you think anything has changed between then and now.
I wrote these sentences to say that I don't want to judge people, because I don't know how, who I would have been during the war. And so that for me, it was a way to say we have always to be careful, because during the war, people, a lot of people, majority of people, only did what they could. Just, yes, to survive. And so that's why I wondered, maybe will be judged in 15 years for my behavior now, because I do what I can in my life. And so that's why I try to wonder, am I indifferent in my life, in my daily life today? And that's why this book led me to try to be a better citizen in my life, and to be to pay attention around what happened in my country.
Changing a little bit to a different focus of the narrative and of your history, Miriam and Vicente lived in Paris at a time of thriving intellectual and artistic life. Tell us a little bit about your relationship with Francis Picavia and art in general, and what influence that has had on your life.
So Francis Picabia, you know, he was a very important painter. And so he was my grandfather. And her son married Miriam, so my grandmother. And I wrote a book with my little sister, not about Francis Picabia, but about his wife, Gabrielle. She was an amazing character. She was so the wife of Francis Picabia, but also the mistress of Marcel Duchamp. They had a triangle, yes? Ménage à trois, so French. It's a cliché, but a threesome. And I wrote this book about her because she was the brain who led them from figurative to abstraction. Because she was so smart that her husband said, because she was not a pretty woman, he said she had an erotic brain. Because she was so smart that all artists fall in love with her. She was the best friend of Guillaume Apollinaire. She was a witness at his marriage with Pablo Picasso. They were the two witnesses of the marriage. And she was extraordinary. And in the book I wrote with my little sister, she's young. And in this book, she's an older woman. She's 60 years old. And she entered into the resistance fight. She walked through Paris with a landau, comment on dit, une poussette,
a stroller,
as if she were a very good grandmother. But there was no baby inside the stroller. It was the papers and all the documentaries for England. And this network was created by her daughter. And it was the network of the artists because they enrolled all the artists in this network. And that's how the translator of this network was an unknown writer who was writing his first novel. So he hid the papers for England in the sheets of the manuscript. And this unknown writer was Samuel Beckett. That's chapters, a lot of... I discovered all this story. And so you have in the book chapters about the network. But it's so amazing that I will write with my little sister another book only about the network.
Yes, there's so many books within the book. I mean,
yes,
really, literally, but also with all these parallel stories that happen. It's so interesting. It was my impression as I was reading through the book that your personal journey that led you through the research was also your personal journey of coming to terms with your Jewish ancestry, since you weren't really brought up Jewish. Now that the process is finished, the research finished, you know, you found the answers that you were looking for, you wrote the book. How has your life changed with this newfound identity, if that's what you call it now?
During my investigation, I discovered something that I call in the book the invisible transmission. It means all the heritage your ancestors give to you, even if you don't know them. when I was investigating, I discovered, for example, that I live in the same street as where my grand uncle lived. And it's a very little street in Paris, and Paris is very big. And I discovered a lot of coincidences that I will not spoil, because you will discover it reading the book. But I was really interested, and I read a lot of articles about what scientifics call the cellular memory. I was fascinated by the fact that our cells have a memory of emotions of our ancestors over three generations. And it was beautiful for me to think that my ancestors were still living in me. When I was 25, I was through a kind of depression. And I met a therapist who worked only about family tree. It was a family tree therapy. And you have to draw your tree on a large board. And the way you are drawing your family tree shows things to the therapist. And after, you have to work over three generations, as in the scientifics. Yes, in the cells, you have to work about a lot of days. Birthday dates, death dates, marriage dates, catastrophes that happen in the family, the first names, how the first names travel in the family tree. And it was very important to me to understand that you have an heritage inside you when you were born. And so I worked about it. And but to go to your question about Judaism, of course the book changed something to me, because I was born, I as explained in the book, in a so secular family. My parents were students during May 68. They were very militants. Our God were François Mitterrand, Che Guevara, and it was socialism was our religion. So I never went into a synagogue until I was, I don't know, 20 years old. That's why I spent all my life to ask myself, what does that word Jew mean to me? Why am I Jewish if I don't believe in the religion, if I don't go to synagogue? I was obsessed by this question since I was a child, and that's why I wanted to understand. And in this book, I explain why I can say now I am Jewish. I didn't say it before, never. And a lot of people who know me in France say to me, reading the book, I didn't know you were Jewish, because it was hidden, and because I had to understand why. So I explain it in the book, a lot of pages, I explain why I am a Jew of the third generation. What does it mean to be part of the third generation? What does it mean to be great child of a survivor, etc., etc. But I try to give a very short answer. And I write, what does it mean to be Jewish? I met a man, George, in the book, and he's Jewish. So thanks to him, now I discovered holidays and everything. And my daughters are very happy to go to the Talmud Torah school. So now I feel part of the community, and I'm really happy with that, because this culture was killed because of the Holocaust, and because for my grandmother, God was dead in the death camp. And so for me, being now part of this culture is a way to say everything was not killed, because now I'm part of it. So in France, people were very curious about the book. It had an unexpected success, really unexpected. My mother she's the main character of the book, my mother. She was the first surprised. One month before the book came out, she said to me, I have something to tell you. So we went to the garden, and she said to me, my daughter, people are fed up with this story. People don't want to hear about us and Jewish stories anymore. So don't be sad if nobody buy your book. It's not because it's a bad book. And really, we were surprised. And a lot of people came to me saying, I am not Jewish, but now your family is my family. But at the same time, I discovered how antisemitism is present even in intellectual worlds, okay? And so, of course, when the book came out on the social media, I had antisemitic comments, okay. But what surprised me and what struck me was antisemitism in my world of writer's edition, etc. But as I say, it's mixed. We have to remember that a Yiddish proverb in all the Middle Europe was happy like a Jew in France. Happy like a Jew in France. It was a Yiddish proverb. Why? Because after the French Revolution, France was a country, the sole country where Jews were equals with the other citizens. In all other countries, in Europe, and for example in Russia, Jews were persecuted. They were not citizens like the others. In Russia, they were not allowed to live in big cities, to travel, to have certain jobs, to only 1% of Jews could go to universities. So France was a paradise. Sorry for my awful accent and English, but no. I have to explain that my parents compelled me to learn German at school and Latin and ancient Greek, okay? It was fascinating, but useless for my daily life. And a year ago, when I knew that I will come to visit the USA I decided to learn English. Yes, I worked a lot. But it was so hard to learn because my brain is old now. I was invited in Milano, in Italy, because there is a Holocaust museum. And the first question I said when I visited the museum is, how many Jews were deported in Italy, from Italy? And the guide answered, we don't know really. In France, we know, thanks to Serge Klarsfeld, because all his life, he tried to name all the people in the trains, to find all the photographies. He gave his life to name all the dead Jewish in France. That's an unbelievable work. So that's why when he asked me to come in his office, I was so scared. He looked at me and he said to me, it's a good job. I couldn't believe it. And that's why after, it was really in the beginning of the promotion in France. And that's why I was not afraid after that. Everybody could say everything about my book. Serge Klarsfeld said it was a good job.
It is actually much more than a good job. It is my favorite book of the year so far that I have read. It's riveting, it's moving, it does everything that a novel should do, which is wrap you into its story. And it is just, I don't know, I lose the ability to really talk about it because it was so powerful. It was such a great read. So thank you so much for coming to Miami. Thank you for sharing your story. Thank you.